We used to look up at the sky and wonder our place in the stars. Now we just look down and worry about our place in the podcast and charts. Interstellar is coming up next.
Haven't Seen It with Tim Sestito and Tommy Tevenet. Hello, everybody. Welcome on in. Thank you all so much for listening today. This is a podcast where one of us is watching a movie for the very first time. And today that is Tommy.
Yeah.
Missing out on the Christopher Nolan, the train of his sci-fi epic. I guess he's got a couple of sci-fi epics, but.
Yeah, narrowed down a little bit. But yeah, this is a blind spot for me, which is weird because I've seen all of others Nolan's movies since Dark Knight. I feel like this is just during a period where, like, I have so many blind spots of movies that happened like when I was like taking classes in college during like the college actual semester, because I feel like I didn't go to the movies as much during them. But like when it was the summer or winter break, that was all I do, would go to the movies. So like Interstellar, so many other movies around like, you know, 2014, from like, you know, September to November, were just blind spots where I just never bothered going to the movies then because I was a broke college kid.
Yeah, well, that'll happen. I feel like Chris Nolan for us is the closest thing we get to Spielberg in his prime.
Oh,
I feel like in terms of like cultural, I'm not even talking about like the filmmaking, the quality, like whatever. I'm just talking about like the cultural impact. Since The Dark Knight Rises, he's been the one consistent director, I feel like, that outside of Tenet, which also released during COVID, so I feel hesitant to try to like lump it in because people are like, oh, well, that was a box office bomb. I'm like, yeah, released in 2020. Every movie that released in 2020 was a box office bomb.
Yeah, exactly. You can't count that against him.
That I think that he is like a very much a definitive filmmaker of our generation, very impactful in Tommy and I's generation in terms of growing up and appreciating movies. This is one I saw in college. I did not remember much about it. It just had been 10 years since I watched it. I remember liking it because like I was a 21-year-old guy when I saw it. So like, of course, I was going to like a Christopher Nolan movie.
Yeah.
It's almost like a psyop in your brain of like, it's a Chris Nolan movie. Of course you're going to like it. It's genius. I think I have a much better understanding of what this movie's about. And we will also be able to discuss more of its influences, which I was very ignorant about at the time when I originally saw it as well. But it's a really good movie, structured in the classic Christopher Nolan sense of jumping around and not super cohesive in the plot. I know with Nolan it's all about feeling, like capturing the feeling versus like linear plot line progression. So
yeah,
what
to jump on your point though, like it's one of those things that like my non-filmmaker, like my non-film buff friends that like don't really know directors whatsoever, Christopher Nolan's probably like one of the few names that they know, like Spielberg and maybe James Cameron.
Yeah, they know Spielberg. They probably know Scorsese.
Yeah,
they know the name Hitchcock, even if they haven't watched a Hitchcock movie, but they know of.
Yeah, they heard of the name Hitchcock before.
They know of him, but yeah, Nolan is up in terms of recognizability of a director. Nolan is probably one of the most prolific in history and probably the most prolific of the 21st century. Because what his first film, Memento, was 2000, right?
That was technically his second film. I mean, his first film was, I think, just like a random indie that like didn't really get much coverage. But his first, like, you know, movie that put him on the map was definitely what's it called? Memento. And then, you know, he had Insomnia, then he went to the Batman movies, and from there it's just taken off. Where it's like, okay, this guy's gonna be,
and
like,
he's just gonna do whatever he wants. And he had a very consistent timeline. Like he does, it went from every 2 years to every 3 years after Interstellar, I noticed. Like you look at his timeline, other than the gap between the, well, because he had The Prestige in between Batman Begins and The Dark Knight, and then he had Inception between The Dark Knight and The Dark Knight Rises, and then 2 years between that and Interstellar, and then he's kind of gone 3 years since. And it looks like his next film, which rumored to have like Tom Holland and Zendaya and all these people. I think it speaks to the quality of his films that pretty much every major A-list actor will drop everything at the drop of a hat to have like a 2 second appearance in a Christopher Nolan movie. Like Topher Grace is not that he's like the biggest star in the world, but Topher Grace just random cameo in Interstellar for like 5 lines of dialogue.
I need to also like mention like how like he was, we'll talk about this later, how he was introduced in the movie where I was like, wait, what? Like Topher Grace is just like a doctor in this hospital. Like
So anticlimactic. Like not that he
yeah.
not that his character needed some big introduction, but just like looking up, you're like, that's Eric Foreman. What the
Yeah, like,
hell?
oh, what is he doing here?
I do feel like
So
Topher Grace is definitely, because I've heard he's a very like nice guy, but I feel like he got very typecasted into the Eric Foreman. Like that's just like what his face and body looks like, you know, like you just see him and that's just what you instantly recognize him as.
yeah, and he didn't obviously get casted well after Venom, so that was the whole thing
Yeah, well,
there.
going into that, signing up for the Spider-Man trilogy was a good idea in theory, and then it turned out to be Spider-Man 3, which funny now looking back on it, but not as well received at the time coming out. But speaking of movies, what movies have you watched recently, Tommy?
So this one I won't expand upon because we're going to do a feature episode on this soon, but I watched The Blues Brothers for the first time. Amazing
Oh,
movie. Can't believe I
hell.
never watched it before, but
One of my all-time favorites.
yeah, great movie. We'll be covering that next month, so stick around for that episode. But the one I want to talk about was the one that won a movie night with some friends. We did a movie roulette. The category on Friday was movies of 10 deaths in them. So it could have been horror, action, anything like
Ten
that.
deaths.
Yeah, 10 deaths. And the one that won was a movie I never saw before, the Bruce Willis Shane Black written movie, Tony Scott directed, The Last Boy Scout. Fucking
Oh.
hilarious movie. It was just like the exactly what we needed that night was just a cheesy like 90 like early 90s action movie where Bruce Willis is quipping like the most hilarious one-liners. At one point he has like a puppet that has his hands that has a gun in it, and he shoots people with through the puppet with the gun in it and
So
stuff like that.
that's when I think of Shane Black, I always think of action with like action for the point of consequence, not action for the sake of action. Like I feel like all of his scripts, because they're usually all action oriented, any of the action in it is very much story related and it's always very clever. And like that is an example of a very clever kill.
Yeah, exactly. It was just a movie that like we needed that. We're all drinking and like, you know, having fun, and we're just laughing out loud like the ridiculous shit that's happened in this movie. Like at one point a car crashes into the pool, and then Bruce Willis just keeps on shooting the fucking car over and over and over again to make sure the bad guys are dead. And I was like, this is just what I need right now. A villain at one point kills a officer but says, "Officer, there's a problem. There's a problem. My gun seems to have too many bullets in it," and then shoots him dead. It's like, what a one-liner that is.
That's pretty crazy. That might be a good I've never seen it. That might be a good 2025 episode for the pod, The Last Boy Scout. Might be a good movie for us to cover at some point down the road, maybe for an action month or something along those lines. Movie I watched was She's Out of My League.
Oh, the Jay Baruchel, the
Jay
starring movie.
Baer and Alice Eve romantic comedy, or I guess it's kind of a weird line of like, because it's not in your traditional rom-com setting of like she's not that into you, or how to lose a guy in 10 dates. Like if I think of like classic 2000s rom-com, like that, it's not that structure. It's definitely more in the Judd Apatow structure of comedies, but it's very interesting because it definitely feels like the end of that era. Like
Oh, yeah.
it's got its funny moments in it, but you can kind of tell that genre of movie kind of running out of steam there.
Oh, yeah. I
Maybe
remember.
part of it might be just like star power as well. I feel like compared to the other movies from that comedy group, like I feel like Jay Buhner is probably like the least prolific of all of those guys.
Yeah, Jay Baruchel, I mean, like, unlike those other movies, like, you know, Knocked Up or Superbad or Forgetting Sarah Marshall, that wasn't like a passion project for him. He was just a gun for hire. And I remember seeing that movie like 10 years ago or like 15, whenever it came out. And the only thing I remember was that every single character was like, dude, she's so hot. How could you fucking date her?
Yeah,
Like, oh my God.
that
It was
was
hammering
part of
that
the
point away over and over and
it
over
was part of
again.
the problem of it, and it was like, you know, there were some funny moments in between there, but it felt uninspired,
Oh, yeah, it was lazy.
and it kind of sucks because I feel like if you could have had more successes, and like it does suck too, because I think of a very funny movie like MacGruber came out a year later, and was a terrible box office flop. I've said this before, probably on the podcast, but I felt like The Hangover, taking comedies from, character orientation and more about people to like a more plot oriented structure, kind of ruined audiences' perceptions of comedy. Not that I don't like The Hangover. I think it's a very funny movie. Not that I haven't seen it 500 times at this point, and you could just quote it to death. But it felt like it was such a revelation when that movie came out, just having this kind of plot-oriented comedy with like hints of drama into it and bigger stakes, versus like I think of something like Airplane, which is like there's stakes in it, but it's never taken seriously
It's
whatsoever.
just joke, a joke
It's
machine
just
right there.
joke, 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 joke. And I feel like The Hangover was 2009, and then you have She's Out of My League in 2010, and you just start to see that fall off, and like kind of the death of the studio comedy kind of coincided with like these kind of movies related. And I thought it was an interesting rewatch to go back and kind of like explore that, because I love comedies, and it just sucks that like the ones that were made never got any traction. So then studios were like, well, we're not going to make more comedies. And now they just, if they make a comedy, it's going straight on streaming. Like they won't even dare release it in a movie theater.
I mean, like our big comedy stars from like, 15 years ago when we were like growing up in like high school and middle school, like Seth Rogen and like Jason Segel, like the Apatow guys, they're going to TV where like Seth Rogen and Jason Segel both had an Apple TV series that came out in the last year. Both of them were good, but it's just like this could have been a movie. Like 15 years ago, this would have been like a theatrical release comedy where it's like Jason Segel and Harrison Ford are therapists or something. And now it's just like, okay, now it's gonna be like a 20-part episode thing. And it's like, all right. The other thing I remember about She's Out of My League was TJ Miller was in a Hall & Oates cover band.
Yes, he was. He was in a Hall and Oates cover band. So, and TJ Miller's career is so interesting, because I feel like he was always the sidekick guy, except for Silicon Valley, where he was like a sidekick guy, but like the funniest character. And then he had his whole thing where it was like, oh, he's actually a real creep. And then his career kind of died along with that
Oh yeah, I mean,
reputation.
there was like a definite like state like era of Hollywood where like it was like okay, so we're gonna have some like little grubby guy, TJ Miller. He was like the Jack Black of his era, I feel like in a way, except not nearly as talented.
And in not as like he's like the sidekick in like Deadpool, like he was like going to be
And
in
like
like comic book
Transformers.
and Transformers. Like he's going to be in like big action movie sidekick guy. He wasn't going to be in like proper comedies as sidekick guy. But yeah, it's an interesting watch point, because it's this decided decline in, studio comedies, and just like the abandonment of the genre as a whole. Because like I even think about someone like Adam Sandler, and like I don't love a ton of his movies as comedies, but they were always money makers. And then I remember he signed like a Netflix deal in like 2013, 2014, and all of his movies just went directly to streaming. Like it was just a decided death of the genre, and it's kind of upsetting to think about.
I think like the last big studio comedy I can think of, like that's straight up just a comedy, was This Is the End in 2013. So like right after that, it was just like they just stopped. That was like basically the
Yeah,
swan
but
song in many ways.
that was even like an apocalypse movie. Like it had like science fiction, like I'm talking like straight up comedy of just like, here's a random situation. Like I think of Superbad, it's just like kids running around. And I know we had Game Night, and we had Blockers, and there's
Like
a couple
neighbors, I guess, also.
name like there's a couple of other ones, but I feel like there has been a slow decline in the studio comedy. And it sucks, because I think there's something great about sharing a laugh with an audience in a movie theater, and like losing that joy. It started
Like,
around that era.
one of my most favorite like theatrical experiences was when I saw Superbad for the second time that weekend, opening weekend. I was in like 7th grade or 8th grade or something like that, and everyone in the theater was just dying, fucking laughing. And everyone's just like, oh my God, I can't believe we're watching this right now. And I got to see a screen of Superbad earlier this year, and still same energy. It was just so much fun seeing that of a
I mean,
crowd.
I would say the greatest comedy of all time. I'm not.
Easily. Yeah, at
And
least for our
maybe it
generation,
was
that's how we
because we
feel.
were 14-year-old boys when that movie
That's
came out, and it
100% it.
just struck the chord of like 14-year-old boys. But I think like you rewatch it now, and it still holds up. It's just so funny, just decidedly hilarious. But that's my spiel on comedies and the decline of them. Now we're going to take a drastic genre shift. Go into Interstellar.
The Earth is dying.
On November 7th.
I've got kids, Professor.
Get out there and save them.
Here we go.
The director of Inception and the Dark Knight trilogy takes the motion picture experience to a whole new world.
Hang in there, come on.
It's too damn fast.
All right, I'm gonna make it.
Yes, you are.
Hang on.
Oh, you're not prepared for this.
Interstellar, November 7th, rated PG-13.
So Interstellar, released 10 years ago, kind of crazy to even think about, set in a dystopian future where Earth is suffering from a catastrophic blight, famine, and it follows a group of astronauts who travel through a wormhole near Saturn in search of a new home for mankind. So Tommy, for you, what did you know about the movie going into it?
So I knew it was a movie about like people going into like black holes, essentially. I knew it was like a McConaughey thing. I knew that, unfortunately, it got spoiled on me that Matt Damon's in this movie, which just randomly pops up, which must have been insane if you didn't know Matt Damon was in this movie, because I don't think they credited him in the beginning.
Yeah, he's definitely not. It was definitely meant to be a surprise for the audience. And I don't think he did a lot of press for the movie for that reason.
Oh, exactly. So it's one of those things where you just see him, you're like, holy shit, Matt Damon's in this movie. And it's so funny that like 2 years later he's in The Martian, which is just like another, we gotta say, Matt Damon from space movie in
But
a way.
it feels the Mar Did you watch The Martian?
I still haven't seen that one too, so that's a future episode for us
That
probably.
it's covering similar themes, but just such drastically different tones and pacing and tempo. Like, The Martian is the epitome of a movie that you'd watch on an airplane and go, that was pretty good, and then forget about it.
Yeah. So this was like definitely a great watch for me. I watched this on election night because I was like, all right, I just need to like put my phone away and not check like CNN or whatever, like Fox or whatever, all the fucking news sites for like election coverage. I'm just gonna put my phone away, turn it off, and just watch Interstellar and just let it wash over me and just get my mind off anything election wise. So it was great in that aspect. And it was one of those things where I was watching this and this movie like made me tear up a lot. I didn't expect it to be so sad. I knew like the famous scene of McConaughey just bawling his eyes out, because I feel like that's become like a legendary meme these days of like
Yeah, it's always used as like me watching the boys play Call of Duty in 2009, not knowing this is the best time, and it's just like in my brain go, no.
Yeah, exactly. Shit like that. Or like watching like the Knicks like fucking fumble another possession type thing.
It's one of those like watching some sports clip that just is traumatic to a sports fan base, like not realizing how good you had it. It's definitely probably that, and I would say the main theme of Interstellar, which I just want to play here in case you can't picture it in your head. I think a little motif from it is important for us to listen to, so just
this is just the rest of our episode.
this is just the rest of our episode. I was just in a tr I was like not
Just
even thinking there. I was just in a trance listening to this theme.
yeah. We just have this underneath our theme, and like, yeah, we it's just like, okay, guys, silence for the next 40 minutes. But
Just this listen rocks. To us playing a copy of the Interstellar theme. That's just what this podcast is.
And it's great that we're not a video podcast, because you see me swaying my arms back and forth, having them raised up.
Out of rhythm, by the way.
Out of rhythm, completely. Yeah.
That's enough, because it's very much just kind of keeps building off of that. I know that with this theme, he went to Hans Zimmer, Christopher Nolan did, and just told him to write a theme about something important to him, which ended up being, you know, his child. And he wrote, you know, he didn't give him a script. He didn't tell him what the idea of the movie was. It was just something about, you know, a relationship with your child. Yeah. And just like that intimacy.
And he told him, like, no endless strings, like, no big drums, like, don't do that. Just, like, make this a little different. And God, what a fucking, like, theme right there.
Yeah. And Hans Zimmer, when he read the script, was, like, kind of surprised about it. And he said, like, why did you have me go from it this? Because if you knew what the movie was about, you wouldn't have gotten what the meaning of this movie was about. Which Interstellar is about a relationship between a father and a daughter, kind of a son, but mostly about the daughter, Murph, between Coop, played by Matthew McConaughey. Can I just say what a awesome, like, just a cool guy Matthew McConaughey is. Like, he's like the epitome. I wish he had a better filmography in the 2000s. I know he had a bit of a renaissance in the early 2010s, this included into it.
Yeah, the McConaissance.
You know, with True Detective probably being the most iconic of that filmography, but he was, you know, he just has the makings of, like, cool, calm, collected, like, Southern man there. And he definitely carries this movie a bit on his shoulders, I would say. But back to what we were talking about here, that connection between a father and a daughter is really what this movie's about. And it's about leaving for the betterment of your family, right? Like, we spend the first 30 minutes just, like, on a corn farm. And, you know, we see that there's dust storms and there's a blight and different crops just keep disappearing away. Like, this blight is just taking away the last resource we really can make is corn. And it's about that connection. And I think the movie does a pretty good job of building that connection up between the Murph and Coop.
And it's insane, like, thinking of, like, you know, in a way, this is almost like a story about, like, a guy who, like, goes away on, like, a long, like trucker haul or something like that, where, like, you know, he's away from his family for so long, in a way, and how, like, much it puts a toll on your family. And, like, there's that one scene where, like, he's in the room with his kid and he's talking about how he's trying to reassure his kid about, like, I'm not gonna be gone for that long, and he tries to reassure and be like, oh, like, you know, maybe by the time I'll get back, you'll be as old as I am. And it's like, you're not helping, you're making this worse for me, dad. And then how it immediately just cuts from his kid crying, him leaving, and then the Hans Zimmer score swelling while he's driving away. McConaughey is crying. McConaughey is such a great crier in this movie, just so many like great emotions, where, like, he probably just, like, studied his face in the mirror, just, like, seeing how he can contort his face to make it, like, optimized for maximum, like, breakability.
Well, it's funny because you compared it to, like, a dad going on a long truck haul, like, if he's a trucker for his family, and that might maybe be, like, 6 months, maybe, like, maximum.
Yeah, that's the extreme version of this.
This is more of dad's going to get a pack of cigarettes and moves to a new galaxy, because you also then lose contact with your father in that regard, because once they travel to a new galaxy, they can receive messages, but they do not have a way to transmit them back. And I think it's very poignant, and how they set things up. Like, I remember thinking when they go and find the lab, because the rising action is in Murph's room, the daughter's room, there's just a ghost, quote unquote. And you know, they keep finding messages in either binary or Morse code, and that leads them to the lab that they end up having to go to. And we find out later in the movie that it was actually McConaughey communicating through a black hole, which is transmitted from taking the five-dimensional plane into a third-dimensional plane and letting him manipulate time to help save the human race. as the Earth is dying. Little bit of a high brain concept, but I remember thinking, I was like, how the hell did they just like know off of that 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 was like, this is where we need to go, this is what these coordinates are pointing to. And then at the end, it all kind of ties together, especially with the watch that he gives her when she's very emotional about his leaving. But in terms of like the science element of it, how did that resonate with you? Like, I know you're not the biggest science fiction guy. I know you would prefer sci-fi over fantasy, like any day of the week.
just at least, science was my worst subject in school. I feel like because I can't bullshit science or math as much as I can English or history. But I think the science in this was like simple enough that like I was able to understand it to an extent. Where like I'm obviously not going to understand like, the intricacies of this, but this wasn't a movie like what was that like time travel movie that came out like in like the mid
Looper.
2000s? No, more confusing. There's just like it took place in a box or something like that. It
I
was the
do. Hot Tub
I'm
Time
Googling it.
Machine.
Primer. There's a movie called Primer that came out like in the mid 2000s. I watched once that like it's all about time travel and the intricacies of time travel. And it's the most complicated, confusing movie where you watch it once and you're like, I don't know what the fuck I just watched. Like, what happened to this plot? And we have to have like a Wikipedia entry that just like breaks down the different plot and timelines and everything like that. And this wasn't like that. Interstellar was not that confusing. I was able to grasp it. Christopher Nolan was able to break it down to a point where it was like understandable. Maybe I don't understand like the intricacies of it, but it doesn't mean I am confused as hell by the plot.
Well, listen, after 100+ episodes or so, I think it's safe for our audience to know that neither of us are astrophysicists, so we're not going to be able to break down the components of would this realistically be possible as space travel. But I felt like for the most part it was reasonable for what it's going for. Like, I'm able to, it got definitely got the time jumps correct. If you like true science fiction, like in terms of Star Trek, is like taking the realities of what we know today in science and basing the future technology that we're able to actually have, basing it into reality of like how it would actually function, which is these things would take a lot of time. And that's a major theme of this movie is the time commitment, the sacrifice in terms of trying to find a new planet. Like, is it worth missing your entire family's life to hopefully save your family and the human race?
Yeah, I mean the fact that they give an emotional connection to it really just makes it greater than like other movies that are just too much bogged down in it. They had a th theoretical physicist, Kip Thorne, who's like a Nobel laureate, basically as the scientific consultant for this movie, where like he talked about how he worked on equations that enabled tracing of light rays as they travel through a wormhole or around a black hole. And he's like, so what you see in this movie is based on Einstein's general relativity equations.
Theory,
So.
so it's based off of his theory of relativity.
Yeah, essentially. So in that aspect, they try to make it like really as accurate as possible. Obviously there's some cinematic liberties. I don't feel like we obviously know what going through a black hole is. I don't think there's any way for us to really know because
Well,
you die.
nobody's done it.
Yeah, nobody's lived through it,
So you do
obviously.
get to just take those cinematic liberties to tell your story, which I think works in this case. I mean, for me, the most apparent influence on this movie is 2001, A Space Odyssey. I know Tommy and I do want to cover this, but we are waiting for it to have a re-release in theaters.
Yeah, I'm
So,
not wasting my first time on like a TV. As great
yeah.
as my sound stereo is on
No,
TV.
it's, it, and like, I think of that 2001 is the epitome of like theatrical excellence. In terms of sound design, cinematography, all of that, and taking these high concepts that are not squeezed together in a traditional film structure. Like Interstellar has a far more traditional film structure than 2001, I would say. But in terms of the visual liberties of 2001, even from the spinning spacecraft, like that's straight out of 2001. Man, like, and the travel and like the visuals when traveling and the bending of time and reality and what that concept is, like These are all from 2001, man. Like, that movie is so influential and it's very apparent here. But yeah, if
Well,
you
when you
have.
break down with Nolan, like what he said, like his key touchstones were of like for this movie. Obviously, not Shocker 2001's in there. Blade Runner's in there. Star Wars, Alien, Metropolis, all like the big like sci-fi movies you think of. Especially, you can see a little bit of Alien too, with like Discovery going on to a new planet and everything, which reminds me of like Nostromo landing on, was it LV-426 or whatever? Some random. So
That's
I think
those
that's right.
if you tell me the, you know, I feel like I'm a pretty good trivia player, but then it's like in Aliens, the second film by James Cameron, what is the name of the, what are the digits of the planet they land on?
Yeah, but regardless, you
I
can see
don't.
the influence of there. We're like, the first planet they go on, how it's like the wave planet reminds me so much of just the Nostromo, like their ship just laying on the alien planet in Alien. And in that aspect of like the different planets, how they fuck with like the physicality of like the difference of it. In a way, this is where my mind's going to. It reminds me of like how we had that movie Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, how they did not have crazy concept for the multiverse for the most part. It
No.
wasn't like anything insane where it's like, oh my God, can you imagine this? But this movie, you just land on a new planet and it's just like, this planet is just a tidal wave planet. And it's like, that is terrifying, especially the way how it goes so slowly with everything. And
Yeah.
one planet's just the ice planet and everything. In a way, I would have been cool to see a little more planets, but I think what they did with the planets they had was
Well,
just great cinematic like
you need
language.
the, well, for the sake of the drama is you're battling time, right? And when you come to these planets, there's different time functions, you know, in terms of when they're landing and the time it's going to take to go through the different or, you know, portals. Like the wave planet, they said 1 hour on that planet is 7 years off Earth. So, whoa, you know, they're battling time, they're battling fuel, and they're battling a black hole in this galaxy, and they're also going off of 3 out of 12 reports on planets that have Earth-like capability to sustain human life. That's what they're looking for. Now, there's a plan A where they're able to do something with the relativity theory of gravity to be able to get a space station with people off the ground, which is what they're looking for. And, you know, Michael Caine gives Hoop his word, Dr. Brand, that he will be able to, you know, figure this out. Or plan B, taking genetic codes and repopulating, which is the actual plan, as we learn. And that's like the big betrayal of the movie, is that there was never any intention from Dr. Brand, the scientist leading this expedition, that they were going to be able to save the human race on planet Earth. That it was about just sustaining human life as far
In
as we
general.
go. So let me ask you, because I would say it's more antagonisty than villainy. I would say Matt Damon's character, Dr. Mann, definitely more of a villain by his actions. Like, how did you feel the Michael Caine twist of things came across? Because by this time, Murph, Hoop's daughter, is grown up and working with Dr. Brand. How did you feel that twist came? And the
It wasn't particularly shocking for me. I mean, I felt like I could have seen that coming away. Or I was thinking like midway through the movie, it's like, all right, how are they gonna get like everyone from like planet Earth to this specific planet if this planet ends up working out? But I think just the emotional resonance of it was really good. Of like, Jessica Chastain, who I thought was excellent in this movie, and just
definitely.
it's a sign of like such a great actor when like all you're doing is really just talking to a camera, and you're so compelling. That one scene where she says like, Dad, I'm the age that you were today, and this is when you said you'd be back, and you're not back yet. And that hit me like a gut punch right there.
The
And
other
it
one
was.
was when she tells, you know, Dr. Brand's daughter, played by Anne Hathaway, in space, like, did you know? Like, did my father know? Because, you know, that's Michael Caine's character, his dying breath to her is that the theory was never going to work. I had it solved 30 years ago.
Yeah, while he's talking about some random poem, it's like, forget the poem. Just tell me about this relativity thing.
Yeah, and it's you know, it's heartbreaking. I think it was clear that it was going to be set up that way, and the manipulation. And I do love the in between of that where, you know, the kids are not going to know that for sure, that their father did not know this and still left them anyway. Like, that's a sense of abandonment and pain. And it's definitely communicated through the movie very well. We also have his son Tom, who's played, the young version's played by a very young Timothée Chalamet. I feel like maybe his first feature or prominent feature debut, because I remember him most from Lady Bird, was like the first time I remember being like, that's a guy, that's going to be a guy.
Looking at his filmography, I mean, yeah, this is the first year of one of his first movies, because he did a Jason Reitman movie like around the same time, same year. So it's insane to think of one of those things where it's like, oh, I feel like it'd be a trivia. Like, who played young Casey Affleck? And it's funny that Casey Affleck's voice is higher than Timothée Chalamet's voice is in this movie.
Yeah. Well, it's one of those continuances that I can't. You know, I was actually having a conversation with a friend about, we were talking about like plot holes and like plot holing made sense. And I was trying to like explain to him my, how I watch movies, right? And I used my go-to example of like plot versus story, like, right? Like, so what's the plot of the Lord of the Rings? The plot of the Lord of the Rings is to get the ring in the volcano. That's the plot of it. But what's the story? And the story is everything that happens in between and what happens to the characters. And I say, you take like the three levels of plot, story, character, and you basically inverse it. The audience should be looking at the characters and the story, and the plot is just the anchor behind it, which is why I get kind of annoyed at like when people are very nitpicky of plot holes in movies. I'm like when they're very like, well, this doesn't make sense if this and that, and I'm like, all right. Right, relax. Like, how does it work in
What's
real? How does the characters impact? Like I say, great writing is characters impacting the story, not having it happen to them. And I feel like this movie can kind of falls in between those two marks, right? Where, you know, Coop makes the decision to go through this and abandon his family, but he wasn't given all the story. But that's just like a classic twist, right? Like it's like all of his decisions impact it. And you see the decisions, because the decisions they have to make is they have three planets they have to go to. They're racing against the clock because in their mind, it's about getting back home and seeing, at least for Coop, because that's the main perspective we're given. You know, everybody else on board is kind of fine, never seeing Earth again. But Coop's main objective and directive is making sure that he gets home to see his family again.
And it's insane with the whole time dilation thing. It reminds me of some Queen song called 39 that talks about that, of like a spaceship that goes out and like, oh my God, now my daughter's as well as me. That's the basis of the song. But when you go on the first planet and you realize like, oh, like 20 years have passed. Like, we've been on here for too long. And that was maybe like 10 minutes of their time, and just how the wonkiness of that affects you. So it's
Very
just the,
Cats in the Cradle.
yeah, oh, yeah, exactly. It's like, oh, I just missed all this shit.
When you're coming home, son, I don't know when. We'll get together then. Gonna have a good time then. No,
If this is a video podcast, you see me swaying again.
that definitely has that abjects of it. I think a big point is discussing Dr. Mann, Matt Damon, because he's like the jump surprise of the movie. Like, we keep hearing about this legendary Dr. Mann who led the first expedition of these astronauts looking for planets. They basically went into deep hibernation if they were able to, in hopes that somebody would wake them up at some point in time. And
I have to just say real quick with like the Wes Bentley character, when he was explaining that, it was like how like these 12 guys and they all went to these different planets just as come back, and they're really brave. And then Matt Damon, not Matt, Matthew McConaughey was like, oh, so how'd they get back? He's like, hence the bravery. And that just like made my mind swirl and being like, oh my God, how horrifying that is. And when they go into Matt Damon, when they reveal him, he says, I have not, you don't know what it's like to not see another human being for like years and years. He was by himself, and how much it just fucked him. In a way, it's a sympathetic villain where like you can understand where he was just thinking about his own survival, where he was just like, I
Yeah,
can't go through this anymore.
well, his mind was quote unquote towards the mission, right? But also about his survival as a human being. And you go into 20, 30 years of isolation, essentially, and probably longer if you take a longer hibernation nap.
Yeah,
It
and he even says at the end, like, I didn't even set a wake up time for my last hibernation. He just
yeah.
assumed, like, I'm dead, I'm done.
Yeah, and you know, he what he does is on the planet, which is the ice planet, he basically lies about the data, saying that, you know, we're on this ice planet, but down on the shelter, we found evidence that it can sustain life. We just need to be able to probe down there, be able to make a way, because it would be something that we could sustain human life on. And you know, Coop's like, great. All right, cool. Let's get it all set up. Let's see if we can dilate time, and I'm on my way home. Y'all can stay. I don't give a fuck. And then Matt Damon's like, well, let's go down here for this mission, which not really explained, but not the point. And Matt Damon just starts attacking him. And then this is where probably my biggest, like, again, I just said, like, I'm not crazy on plot holes, but McConaughey's character has plot armor to the max.
Oh yeah, I mean it's one of those things I didn't really watch away, but like, you know, he gets his like helmet cracked. The way that's kind of funny, like, how the fight went down. Where, like, it's just like, all right, so you're just like have him stand above you, and Matt Damon starts headbutting his helmet over and over again. And it's like,
Yeah.
wouldn't that crack Matt Damon's helmet too? Like,
Well,
what's
he
going
does.
on
Well,
here?
there's a line being like, there's a chance this can fuck you up too. And he's like, 50-50, I'll take my odds. It's better than anything I've had since I've been out here. But Matt Damon's character basically lied to them to complete the mission and basically just commandeer the spacecraft and leave them there to die. Which kind of feels weird because it didn't seem like his plan. And granted, I imagine 30 years of isolation will make your plan not make a ton of sense. But his plan was just, I'm going to abandon this crew that woke me up, even though I was devastated from having no contact with human beings for 100 years. And then he's just like, well, here's the only people I've seen in 100 years. I'm going to steal their ship and never talk to them again.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I'm immediately going out. So real quick on Matt Damon, I have to ask this question because I was thinking about this. Is Matt Damon like the A-lister that has like the most sort of random cameos, like unexpected cameos in movies?
Yes, he.
Because think about it, we had a Euro Trip where he's like the Sky Doesn't Know guy. We had like he popped up in like Jay and Silent
Thor.
Bob as himself.
He was in Thor.
Yeah, as like a Loki
Or,
actor. He was in
yeah.
this. I'm trying to think of any others, but like there's so many random ones where it's just like, oh shit, that's Matt Damon. What is he doing in this movie?
Yeah, he likes to have fun. I appreciate that about Matt Damon, that he got to a point in his career where he's like, I'm. You're a director and you're my friend, and you think it'd be fun if I showed up on set for a day?
Yeah,
All
he's
right.
also Deadpool too. That's like a redneck, I remember. Just like I forgot about that
Well,
one.
and Brad
But
Pitt was in that one too, where he gets a,
oh, the
like he was
invisible
like the
guy.
invisible guy, and then we only see him for a frame when he gets electrocuted, like, and then Ryan Reynolds, you know, I'm not the biggest fan of his. I think his persona comes off a little fakey, but he has that clip where he's like, he tells the studio, like, Brad Pitt's agreed to be in it. It's like, oh great, oh really, wow, we can include him. No, he's going to be the invisible man. You're going to see him for a tenth of a second. Which it's
Half a
funny be
second.
because if you're like a marketing executive or studio executive, you're like, oh great, we got Brad Pitt, like moving the press junkets and all this marketing. They're like, no, he's agreed to be in this for a frame of time. He's going to be on the
We
set for
can't
10
afford that
minutes.
much Brad Pitt right here. Like, let's calm this down a little bit.
And it is funny when it's done that kind of way. But
So back to Interstellar, real quick. Can we just talk about how awesome Case is? And TARS,
oh,
both
the
those
robots.
robots. Oh,
Yeah.
I just love the robots in this movie. Just like their design of how like they're just essentially just like square cube things, and just their voices. One of them's voiced by Bill Irwin. I forgot what the other one's voiced by, but oh, Josh Stewart, like two random actors I don't really know much of, but their personalities were both just so much fun, and just like it was insane just how it went over, and how like the one part of like TARS saves Anne Hathaway on the water planet. How cool that was. It's
Oh
like
yeah.
TARS isn't that fast. Like, how is he gonna get there? And all of a sudden it's like, oh, he's using his like square wheel things.
Ours is a machine, both literally and figuratively. And I thought it was really cool how TARS like was when they go into the black hole. So essentially the what leads to the climax of the film is when Matt Damon tries to escape, he's trying to get to the main craft that's huddled outside of orbit. And you know, he doesn't get the airlock right because he doesn't have the codes to be able to line it up properly. And his thing explodes and the craft is spinning all over the place. And like, if that little shuttle is just left alone, like they're fucked. There's like mission over, guaranteed failure for the human race. And they do this crazy chase to get the airlock back onto the main ship. And one thing I do want to touch up on here is the use of practical effects, and how, especially in modern movies, when you watch great practical effects, it makes you go, "Oh, could we just leave visual effects in the dust, please?" Like, oh my god.
Even if like the set design of this movie, so like, you know, how much this movie takes place on a farm in a cornfield. They actually made all that corn, like Christopher
and then
Nolan.
They sold it for a profit.
Yeah, they grew 500 acres of corn, and he realized that's feasible because of Man of Steel, apparently. But it's one of those things that, like, I feel like so many movies today would just be like, "I'll just green screen it." You know, like how
we'll plant like 10 acres and we'll just green screen the beyond of it. Yeah, probably. Honestly, probably not. Probably you're right. Probably not.
Probably not even that. Because, like, you know how they filmed that Spider-Man movie, like No Way Home, and like how so much of it was just green screens. And it's like you couldn't shoot. Oh, granted, it's COVID, so I'll give a little leniency there, but still, just like most of it was just like green screens. You couldn't shoot in the streets of New York. Like, are you kidding me? That's what.
That was actually the perfect time to shoot in the streets of New York. Nobody's walking in the streets of New York. You have free reign of the streets.
Yeah.
And granted, wouldn't you want, in COVID times, wouldn't you rather be outside where the risk of the spread is lesser than if inside in an enclosed area, right? Like, is that not? But yeah, but your point stands. But, you know, that was like the great action scene in this movie where they have the ship chasing the main hub of it and watching the trying to latch onto it with through the debris, and it's all just stunning. Like, the cinematography, absolutely stunning. The way the ship goes, absolutely.
Even Tars is just a puppet, not a CGI creature for the most part. I mean, I think there's a couple shots, maybe the majority of Tars is just
again,
puppets.
We've said and it's the Jurassic Park lesson, right, over and over again, when you blur your effects together, the audience probably will not pick up on it unless they're doing like a frame by frame breakdown of it. In motion, it's going to look very convincible because the trickery is that it's just, you saw it as a real object and now it's moving in a way that the real object couldn't, but so much is going on in that sequence that your eye isn't really prepared for that kind of motion, right? There's definitely CGI in this movie, like especially like the wave planet and stuff like that. But it all looks fantastic, and it's used minimally. And I really feel like that's a big, like, part of what makes this movie last. Because, like, I'm thinking of that chase scene, right? And if you had that with CG, I don't think it would look anywhere near as compelling as it does in practical effects.
No.
And it just makes that tension feel so much more palpable, where you're like, this is really happening right now.
It's the great thing about Christopher Nolan, like how he's just able to do this. And so it was a version of this movie. This originally was set up to be a Spielberg movie back in like 07 or something like that. And, you know, in June 2006, they announced plans for this with Paramount. Spielberg was going to direct it. Joffrey Nolan was hired to write the screenplay. Then Spielberg moved DreamWorks from Paramount to Walt Disney. And Paramount's like, okay, you're not doing Interstellar anymore. We need a new director. And Joffrey Nolan's like, I have this brother, Christopher Nolan. Have you ever heard of him?
Might have heard of a little movie called The Dark Knight.
Yeah. And then they're like, okay, fuck yeah, we'll get Christopher Nolan to do this. Let's do that instead. And it ended up being like such a great pairing right there. And it's crazy, like the weird politics behind this movie where like Legendary agreed to forego financing of Batman v Superman in exchange to get a stake of Interstellar. But, like, we don't care about this big IP, Batman v Superman. Who are they? Fuck them. We want Christopher Nolan.
And they were...
Batman vs. Superman.
I don't know. I don't think... Probably not in the box office sense where they were right, because Batman vs. Superman, like, even though it underperformed, it still made... I think it still cleared $1 billion. I got very close to it.
I mean, it wasn't that far off, though. I mean, Interstellar made, like, 730 worldwide, a million worldwide. Batman vs. Superman made 874 million worldwide.
Oh, yeah. But, and you got the better movie.
Yeah, and you got the better movie, though. So
actually,
it's just
the
like,
profit
right.
margin might be there because the budget of Interstellar is going to be less than something like Batman v Superman would be.
Yeah. But it just like talks about how much of like a power Christopher Nolan had, where he's an IP in himself. I mean,
Well,
Oppenheimer.
he is, yeah, like you said, had, like he still had, he just won Best Director at the Oscars, and Oppenheimer is probably one of the most definitive films of the 21st century, I would argue, in
Yeah,
terms of
and
like mass appeal and like actual like film quality.
if like Oppenheimer was directed by like a random other director, I don't feel like it would have made if it was like the
In
same quote.
insert Indie Darling from Sundance and give him $150 million. Well, Oppenheimer wouldn't have been made without Christopher Nolan because, as you said, he himself is the brand, right? It's a Christopher Nolan movie. And it's so interesting because he got his popularity from the Batman movies, but it was really that distinction of The Dark Knight and that shift in tone and what, comic book movies could be that made it go, oh, no, this is a Christopher Nolan movie. It's not a Batman movie because it's not even a Batman movie. It's just heat in Batman's.
Yeah, exactly. As we've belabored before.
Yeah, as we belabored before, but I wanted to touch on the ending when they get into the black hole and they're in this like five dimensions and the creatures or beings, which they kind of say are human beings evolved past the point we could even comprehend and they're able to manipulate time. I know it's the cop out for the ending because you really can't end this movie on, well, the human race dies.
Game
Game
over.
over. Like, that ending would not work. But we see back in Murph's bedroom, as I mentioned before, and McConaughey realizing that this ghost that had been in Murph's bedroom was him all along communicating through this dimension where he knocks Stay into it. And Jessica Chastain as present day Murph trying to rescue Tom's family who are basically dying from this cop. But he's so stubborn. Like they set up this whole stunt, so there's like this pressure against the clock, which I feel like isn't really. It was like a false flag pressure cooker of like, we gotta go. And I was like, okay, like this is gonna
Well, it's
work
funny
out.
because
It's
it's
one of
like
those where I was like, I'm not feeling any tension from this. This is going to work out because the connection between Chastain and McConaughey and young Murph in that section is just so much more compelling. Like every time they cut to Topher Grace being like, Murph, Murph. The
that's
fire,
really
I'm
all he
like,
does. And like like I said earlier, it's how he's introduced to this movie is just so random. Where he's just like, I was like wondering, like, did I like fall asleep during a sequence where they properly introduced Topher Grace?
and
And if
you
I
would.
correct me if I'm wrong, but like
No,
it
he's just
was,
in the hospital.
yeah, he's just in the hospital. He's like, he's over there to
It's when
Michael
Dr.
King.
Brand's dying, and then apparently they were in
That's
a
it. Yeah, okay,
relation
that was
too.
it. That was it. I was like, wait, when Topher Grace entered this
Yeah.
movie?
But
But no, I agree
the
with you because like the Matthew McConaughey part of like where they split between the tension of like Casey Affleck's gonna come back soon, and then where Matthew McConaughey is doing was so much more compelling. Where he's like, "Is Matthew McConaughey gonna make it okay like through this
Yeah,
thing?"
is the human race going to be saved? And he basically communicates through Morse code through the watch that he gave Murph at Murph, and he basically the time for the they basically through this black hole were able to figure out the gravitational situation, which not an astrophysicist, I was a little bit like, I'm not gonna get this, but I'm in this world, fine, whatever. Like they've done enough convincing science that this is the real deal here. To communicate through him. And it was gorgeous cinematography. It definitely took, again, influence from 2001 in this sequence, but definitely did its own thing with it in terms of like the coloring and like what was going on in it. But when it passes through dimensions and warping time in this one versus something like 2001, like that was a lot more of its time in that like trippy 60s, 70s, like kind of lighting, and this was a little bit more of like what you would expect from a Christopher Nolan movie, like gorgeously striking, but a little bit more of a muted color palette.
And the sound design was so incredible once they went into the black hole. I thought it was just so cool, just like how they went about that. And the production design in general. One thing I want to touch upon is like how low key this apocalypse is and how much I appreciate that. It's not like
Yes.
very flashy, it's not like a Michael Bay thing where it's
It's
just
just
like everything's
dust.
on fire. It's just there's a bunch of dust, crops aren't really growing. There's the little subtle things, how like everything they eat is like a variation of corn, essentially, where it's just like, make sure you eat your corn fritters and everything. And how they like, basically set up in small ways where it's like they're at a baseball game. You think it's just some like random like local high school game or
And it's
whatever.
the
And it's like,
Yankees playing out at like a high school field because there's just not that many people left. And I like how that is communicated to the audience. of like what has happened, and it's more subconscious versus some exposition dump of like, it was the Great War of 2124, and this
Yeah,
happened,
like
blah, blah, blah. And I'm like,
they could have
okay.
easily had Lithgow or Kane just like narrate over it. And I like how it's like basically like almost everyone's just a farmer, where it's just like, forget everything else. We just need farmers. Can you farm? Perfect. Timothée Chalamet, you got bees. You're a farmer now.
Yeah,
Guess
exactly. And
what?
that's like the point of contention with it. And it does feel like if there was ever a crisis on Earth, this would be one of the tangible
Yeah.
possibilities of Earth is a massive famine sweeping across the planet. And I think that it works and strikes that tone. But then I want to talk about the very end because, he communicates the code, and then they fall out of the black hole, and they're back in Earth's galaxy, right by Saturn, where the wormhole initially was. And then we fade to white, and then Coop wakes up in a hospital bed, and his daughter did it. And I was like, it would have been cool to see that. Start, like I was hoping we were going to something more of like a heaven kind of transfigure where he can see what happened. But
Instead of like
him.
literally seeing like Ellen Bernstein pop up and be like, yeah, you shouldn't be with me. Like, here's like all your Israeli family. You don't need to be a part of this. This isn't your life. You don't see
And
your kid back.
it's like you're 120 years old. You're an old man now. And even though it's like McConaughey in his like early 40s still. And
It's so weird, like how many heaters are in this movie, like random, like one line cameos. Like one of the nurses that says, like, oh, she's down the hallway, Ellen Bernstein. That's the girl who gets kidnapped and sent to the lamps.
is that really?
Yeah, I found that out recently when I was looking through IMDb. I was like, wait, what? So.
That's pretty crazy. But I didn't love that Coop lived, and the way he lived, because he lost his ship in a black hole, and then was just floating out of Saturn and got picked up. And like, obviously, I know there's time space, but it felt like his character was ready to make the ultimate sacrifice. Like he sacrificed himself so that in the case that they couldn't figure out this problem, Anne Hath like the human race could continue on this other planet if Anne Hathaway is able to get there. And then him being able to communicate to his daughter, being able to save the actual population of the human race, I felt like was not great.
I mean, I did like though, like how like the little sci-fi thing of like how there's like this like planet where you can tell like, oh, this is like a spaceship where they're playing baseball and all of a sudden it's just like a curved planet where it's like
Yeah.
that's a cool little
It
sense of
was
time.
cool. And it was visually cool, but it was
I
one of
agree with
those.
you, but yeah, I was like, kind of, I was like, oh, he just gets saved. Like, okay, this is random. Like,
But yeah, that was that. I had my issues with the ending there, but I know it works for a more happy ending.
I am a star. I'm a star, I'm a star, I'm a star. I am a big, bright, shining star.
All right, Tommy, who's the star of the show? Who gives the best performance in this movie?
I have to go. It's tough. I mean, like, I want to talk about McConaughey, a little bit of a piece on him real quick, where I think McConaughey is incredible in this movie. I mean, like, there's that famous meme moment we talked about of him crying, reacting to his kids watching it, and that just washed over me and like just immediately like just hit me like right in the like emotional bone, where it's like crazy. And when you think about this is the period of the McConaissance, and you talked about earlier, like how like McConaughey in the mid 2000s was very in the wallow period. I mean, he was basically known at that point as like the dumb rom-com guy. I mean, he made like Failure to Launch. He was in like some mediocre drama called We Are Marshall. He made Fool's Gold. He's in Tropic Thunder, but that's like, just like a cameo. And then he's in Ghost of Girlfriend's Past, where it's like, all right, this guy's gonna be like your mid-budget rom-com guy. He's gonna be in shitty movies. And then 2011 happens, Lincoln Lawyer comes out, received
Then
pretty well.
True
Bernie's does pretty
Detective
well. Then True
from
Detective, we have.
Dallas Buyers Club, and it just shows us the actual range that he has as an actor.
Yeah. And like he got cast off this from the movie Mud, which was a good movie I've seen before. And basically, Nolan was like, he's hitting this. And I feel like at the time, like Legendary or like Warner Bros. Paramount, probably just like, you want to cast the Ghost of Girlfriend's Past guy? And you're like, No, trust me, this guy's hitting. He's gonna make a comeback right now. And this is essentially probably the apex of the reconnaissance in a way. Maybe True Detective, A or B. But then now we're kind of back to McConaughey being just like in random trash where he's
Well,
just like.
he's more interested in like running the Texas football, the Texas Longhorns football team, and being on the sidelines for all those games versus making movies. He's got his money. He's just doing his own thing. If he wanted to do a project like this again, I feel like he would and could. I just feel it because he is such an A-lister that I think he is still one of the few that could bring people in based off of his name on the poster alone, especially if
But
the
it's weird is he hasn't done like things in a while. I mean, like, in 2024 he had a cameo as like Cowboy Pool in the Deadpool movie. And before that, I mean, he was in Sing 2, and that's the only movies he's done this
He's
decade.
not
It's
and he's like he released that book, Green Books or whatever it was called. He's more interested in just doing what he wants to do and live and laugh, man, you know.
yeah, at this point.
But you know, Jessica Chastain also excellent in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, she really just sells the emotional things. And Anne Hathaway, that one monologue, we really touched upon her that much. The one monologue, but like, what if love is tangible? Or, another thing. That's a great little monologue right there, and like how Nolan was able to frame her in that aspect. So,
Over which planet they wanted to go to, because she wanted the hope that the astronaut she was in love with is still there and alive.
and I think the real star of the show is Michael Caine's wig job in the beginning of the movie.
Oh yeah, to be like, oh, he's younger, and it's like Michael
He's
Caine
younger
still
Michael
looks eight. He
Caine.
still looks like he's 80 in this,
Yeah, it's like,
throughout the
oh,
whole
sure, you
thing.
sure, you sure you put a little orange in his hair. I don't think that makes him a little younger, Nolan.
Yeah, I mean, again, that stuff doesn't bother me as much as.
But it's fine.
No, it was just funny for sure.
And Damon,
Ah,
great.
are you ready, comedy partner? Waka waka. Okay.
All right, Tommy, would Interstellar work as a Muppet adaptation?
This isn't wacky enough to be a Muppet adaptation, even though I just sent you like some random comic someone made of like Matthew McConaughey meeting the Muppets
But
in the movie.
it's not even like in the movie. It's like if he was in space, and it's like, oh, this ain't the rescue I was expecting. Oh, it's Dr. Mann, and it's like they're all the Muppets now waking him up, which is kind of funny, but
That's what it'd be. It feels like they go to a planet and instead of just like ice planet, it's the Muppet planet where everyone's just Muppets.
I definitely feel like this drama kind of lacks levity in it because of the stakes of the movie. I feel like even something like just Oppenheimer, right, which is still high stakes, definitely has moments of levity and humor in it that this movie is completely void of. And that's fine, like that works for what this is. But if you have no humor in your movie, I don't think you could bring the Muppets into this. But all right, Tommy, review time. Give me your score to five.
Right, so I love this movie. I'm shocked it took me this long to watch it, and it really says something to this movie where I watched this on election night, and I wasn't even thinking about the election when this was what happening, which says a lot, especially how like stressful this election was. Everything washed over me. I mean, it really hit me. Like, I cried a couple times during this movie because of like how emotionally powerful like the McConaughey scenes were, and just the sci-fi-ness of it was great. It wasn't too like bogged down and like theoretical shit where it would make me just like disinterested. And I think the character moments were really good. Great performances. The Hans Zimmer score, which we played for like 5 minutes on this podcast, incredible. Great score.
More like a minute and a
Definitely.
half, but yeah, we played it for a
Yeah,
while.
yeah. But anyways, just everything about this movie really hit. I'm gonna go 4.5 out of 5. Definitely gonna rewatch this again and again. It's something I probably might pick up on 4K eventually. So yeah.
Yeah, I'm gonna go 4 out of 5. I think the ending kind of took the wind out of its sails a little bit for me, as I kind of mentioned there. I just kind of felt like they wanted the happy ending at the end, and it was just a cop out. Like, again, I talked about how I'm not crazy about plot holes and stuff, but McConaughey just drifting through space in a spacesuit, like while you're trying to convince me of all this real science, and then he's just like it doesn't matter if you're drifting endlessly in space, you're dead. Like, I feel like that's a concept that everybody knows. So for me, 4 to 5, I mean, as you said, like the character drama between it is done very well. The stakes of the world and how that's presented, really well done. And just really one of those movies that hits home, definitely a tearjerker in a movie that you maybe wouldn't think it would be a tearjerker for. So 4 to 5. Great movie. Definitely recommend watching it if you haven't watched it. So, Tommy, any final thoughts before we wrap up this episode?
So real quick on Interstellar, it's crazy how this is a mid-2000s 2010s period where like so many space movies came out between like this Ridley Scott going back to the Alien franchise, Alfonso Cuarón doing Gravity, this and The Martian. So still in the air in the mid-2010s. Anyways, thank you guys so much for listening. You can follow us on social media at CNetPod. That's on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, occasional threads, and we're also on that new platform Threads. Our username is different on that. That
Blue
is
sky.
Blue Sky. Yeah, it's a pod seen it dot blue sky. So but anyways, great platform too, so check us out there. Check us out wherever you get your podcasts too. Apple, Spotify, really helps us out. Give us 5 stars. So next week we're covering Gladiator. I've never seen it before. Gladiator 2 is coming out. Timmy,
I've seen like
what's your
half of it on
temperature?
TNT. It's probably going to be fun, but weirdly bulky, kind of like very traditional late stage Ridley Scott, where it'll have
Yeah.
its good moments, but it'll be a little bit of a bulky mess.
So it's getting good reviews. So I'm excited to see Gladiator and Gladiator 2. So stick around for that next week.
Thank you guys all so much for listening. We will see you next time.